Sure, I mean, something like that. The obvious thing to do would be
to argue.
Well, no, you take a very careful look at what's this observational evidence that's being interpreted as stuff receding away. There might be another explanation of that compatible with the finite universe. I mean, what do we shifts in wavelengths or something? Or well, something else might be causing that. It's only one hypothesis that has actual velocity away. All right, let's take a break. It's break time. And when we get back, we'll take a quick zip look at Luther and Paracelsus and see how that will then tie into Copernicus. Okay. All right, let's get back to it. That was no break.
You got a cigarette.
You're talking continually. Okay. Now, we're now going to leave the High Middle Ages and all that and enter the seventeenth century. Now, the big question lurking behind all of this, which plainly we won't have time to take too long about, is can it really be an accident? This business about accidents, coincidences, and causally related things. Is it just a coincidence, looking at things in terms of century-long blocks of time, can it really be a coincidence that this set of events that are somehow put together under the heading scientific revolution, in its longest view from Copernicus to Newton, so 1543 to 1687, or maybe it's really 1600 to 1700. We can play around with these dates. Is it really any accident? Is it really just a coincidence that the scientific revolution, so-called, is something that happens in European culture at roughly the same time as that thing called the Reformation, and as that thing called by different people, you know, we all have to pick an arbitrary date, the bourgeois revolutions, the commercialization of society, the birth of commercial societies, or to put it all in a kind of simple nutshell, the occurrence of essentially capitalist social orders. Is it really a coincidence that these three things are all going on, very, very crudely speaking, at the same time in European culture? The new science, the new religions, a new social order. Surely there must be some connections. Well, I think there are. And I think that we can explore what some of them might be, but, well, we'll do that while paying more careful attention to our natural philosophy stuff than to the other stuff. But there's one thing that we ought to say, that I want to say as a kind of caveat at the beginning of all of this, just to let you know what kind of an activity we're engaged in. If somebody says, I want to do the history of the Reformation, So I want to know about Lutherans, Zwingli, and Calvin, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Henry VIII. And so I'm interested in various kinds of Protestants. What are the people in Calvin's Geneva like? What are the people in Salem, Massachusetts like? What are the people in London like in 1600? And I'll start talking about Lutherans and Calvinists and Puritans and so on. And when I do that, if you've ever been in a class that does this, you'll find out that what goes on is exactly what you'd expect. There's a great deal of discussion amongst historians and students of history about just what exactly a Puritan is, or just what is a Lutheran. Somebody gets up and says, I'm a Lutheran. Well, what does this mean? What does a person mean? What's going on with these terms of these symbolic, these labeling terms? And we realize very easily, this is a historical question. What a Puritan is, in some sense, is what is taken to be a Puritan and does involve what people who announce that they're Puritans a lot are and take themselves to be. All right? So it's a kind of self-reflexive and internal question. Who really is a Puritan in England in 1660? And until we have some sense, historical sense of that, it's going to be hard to talk about the relationships between Puritans and the new science, the Royal Society, and all that stuff. There's a famous argument by the sociologist Robert Merton, Science, Technology, and Society in the 17th Century England, in which he, in fact, does this job of trying to link these three things, and makes an argument sort of by census, almost by Gallup poll, that the number of Puritans in the new Royal Society is disproportionately large, much more than a sample of the English population. Anyway, and ever since, people have been arguing about most of the people he identifies as Puritans just aren't. So, what's a Puritan? Who's a Lutheran? It's a historical question, you know. At the end of the day, whatever we think doesn't matter unless it agrees with what the people there are meaning by the term. Similarly with capitalism, or whatever you want to call it, middle classes, rising gentry, capitalist social order, which might be got at in terms of institutions having to do with property and so on. Or correlated notions like individualism. So to ask in 1650 or 1620 or 1580, is Thomas Hobbes' theory of politics a theory that posits essentially an individualist theory? Does it posit a commercial society, a market order? Well, you have to look and see, and you have to know exactly what Thomas Hobbes or John Locke or John Calvin, some of those really mean. Again, you can see it's a completely historical question. If something like a capitalist social order or a Lutheran religion is coming into being, it's pretty plainly something being constructed by the actors who are constructing it. Right? It's pretty plainly a historical entity. Now, what all of this song and dance is about is to say, it's very easy to forget, and everybody does, that all that stuff applies to this business of science. That is, if you read Merton and lots of other people talking about the connections between science and all this other stuff that's going on, you'll find this kind of, I mean, now it almost looks quaint to some of us, to others not at all, and maybe it's a controversial point, that although there may be a great deal of trouble in knowing really what a Puritan is, and it's a historical problem, and a great deal of trouble in knowing whether England in 1640 is in some sense properly described as having become a market or commercial or capitalist society, there's never any problem about what science is. Right? Well, we all know what science is. It's what those people do. It's experimental, it follows the scientific method, da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. So that's not a historical problem. Science is kind of outside of history. You see what I mean? It's like, it's not a historical category. You know what I mean? Is Copernicus a scientist? Well, you just, no problem, just look. Does he, we have the criteria. Method, experiment, observation, you know? Karl Popper will tell us, or whoever our favorite analyst of science will tell us what science really is, and then we can give points. But notice how screwy this is. This is just like someone who proclaims that we know what a Lutheran really is. And open up the astonishing possibility that even Luther isn't a Lutheran. Do you see what I mean? Here's what Lutheranism really is, and now we're going to see who gets points. That would be Lutheranism kind of outside of history. A history of science that treats science as given, as just a given, and then there's human beings stumbling around in various degrees of darkness, either stumbling on it or not, would be identical to, I mean, I'm giving you a real polemic speech, would be identical to somebody doing the history of Christianity with completely outside of history principles about what Christianity really is and is true. You see what I mean?
People do that.
It's very, oh, I know they do. I know they do. And it would, so very often what happens in explaining something about the history of science, you get explanations that are not very different than, would almost have this kind of form. The reason the Christian religion has succeeded so well, at least up to some point has, right? I mean, it starts out as just another crazy Middle Eastern sun worship outfit. I mean, it's a crazy mystical sect. And there's lots of others around. But after a while, it like, takes over the whole Mediterranean world, right? It becomes a big success if you count followers. The Emperor Constantine decides he's a Christian. And away we go, a very successful religious movement. Why did that happen? A lot of people write about the history of science in the same way a person writing about the rise of Christianity would be writing if they said, well, at the end of the day, though I can describe all sorts of little anecdotes about Constantine and other people, the reason Christianity succeeds, of course, is because Jesus is the Son of God. That's really the reason. And the reason science succeeds, of course, is because science really is what we think it is. Right? It's this royal road to competence of some kind. Right? Science outside of history. And so what's left for history is just a bunch of anecdotes. You know what I mean? And points. Well, Copernicus did pretty good at 740. And Newton did pretty good, except he was distracted by right? When Newton's doing science, he's doing something that's outside of history, in a sense. You see what I mean? It's very hard to say this. That's why all of this is not so easy. Now, the point of view that I'm trying very much to take here, and I guess is the one that informs the rest of what we're doing, in it's almost like the joke you need to get by the end of July, is to come to see in whatever sort of dim way you can. It was pretty dim for me, so I'm not making you inferior somehow. To come to see that this thing called science is as much a historically created entity as any of these other things. And as is much, what science is as much up for grabs in 1660 as what's true religion or what's the way to live together and who's going to have power and who isn't. This is as much up for grabs. What kind of activities are going to constitute genuine cognitive doings? What kinds of activities are going to have intellectual authority? This is as much up for grabs then as anything else. Do you see what I mean? And it's going to depend entirely on what's going on historically, what the struggles are about, who's going to win this struggle about who gets to have intellectual authority in a particular domain. Just as this kind of struggle might be thought of as being about who's going to have legitimate political authority in what kind of domain, right? The history of science is often talked about. Another analogy would be the kinds of books that talk about the history of political systems from the point of view of the necessary and inevitable triumph of democratic polity. So the history of freedom, or something like that. You know, it's a category that's outside of history, and it's something that everybody's struggling for. Now that might be right. I mean, I'm not saying this is crazy. It might be informed by a particular notion that's the sort of trans-historic. But it makes a lot more sense, so we historians think, to look at these things as actual, well, struggle might be too strong a word, up for grabs might be a better way of putting it. Who's going to have legitimate political authority is a question that's up for grabs. And when we write about the history of regimes and political power, we look at just what's going on and why particular ways of arranging things and particular persons gain that authority. And it's all sort of de facto, right? Separately from this, though this activity might well inform and help, I mean, it would be more dialectical than that. Separately from this would be the question of, is that political authority really legitimate? You know, we don't care if 10 million Frenchmen think that the Sun King is the only legitimate authority around. Yes, that may be a fact. That's what passes for legitimacy. Is it really legitimate? This is a question for political theory, I suppose. Right? And we're entitled to have our views about that. Now, I think, just to make things completely muddied, that at the end of the day, the philosophy and the history all, there's a closure, and they really can't keep them apart, finally. That a good political theory is one that's going to be historically informed. But that's another matter. But I see the same kind of closure between a philosophy of science and the history of science, so that at the end of the day, a good theory about knowledge is going to be a historically informed theory. But that's something maybe we'll talk about later. The point of all this speech is to say, the business of what's going to count as modern science is a historical project. And in 1600, nobody knows who's going to win. The Galileo doesn't know who's going to win and Galileo and his friends are a pretty tiny minority. You know? And you might estimate their chances in 1610 as about as good as the chances of, well, I don't know, what? Creation science taking over science education throughout the Western, not the entire world. Anyway. All right, so, what are the things that go into this mix? Well, we could look at it, culminating in Copernicus, as a series of challenges to natural law theory. This is, in one sense, the way one of the nicest books about all of this stuff that was ever written looks at it, a book by a man named Hiram Hayden. Bearing the title, The Counter-Renaissance. This is quite a fat book. I think it's 600 or so pages. There is not a single intellectual figure in the history of early modern Europe that is not in here in an important way. It very much covers the ground. And it's a very good read. And its theme is basically that there's natural law theory, roughly Thomist, challenges to it, counter to it, and a new synthesis, which is by and large for him associated with the new science. But that's just sort of the way he's organizing the material. When you get to the last chapter of the book, I'll give away the punchline just to entice you into reading it someday. In fact, don't allow yourself to leave university before you read this book. Make it part of that project. When you get to the last chapter of this, you find out the whole point of this entire discussion is to help you to understand Shakespeare. Because, Hayden wants to argue, Shakespeare knows about and understands deeply these tensions and is exploiting them dramatically. That's what King Lear's about. Can't understand King Lear.
Connection.
You can't understand King Lear if you don't know that Shakespeare knows that King Lear thinks he's a bad king. And the entire cosmos is offended. You know? Anyway.
Is he saying anything about Bacon and Shakespeare being? If we go back to the science.
I don't remember. I think there's a third party now who is both Bacon and Shakespeare. I'm not sure what the name is. And that's the latest news. It's not Bacon or Shakespeare, somebody else wrote both. It's like all those Homeric poems were written by another blind person named Homer. Right. Okay, so this is sort of how we could organize these things. There are these series of challenges to natural law in its sort of Thomist form. If you have read, I can't imagine you haven't unless you're sort of asleep at the switch, if you have read even cursorily the six and a half pages of excerpts from Luther, it's very hard to avoid the way in which Luther is posing a pretty serious and heavy challenge to any kind of Thomist Aristotelian scheme of things. And I will just mention, almost to remind you, the ways in which he's doing that, or two particular ways he's doing that. And when I mention these things, I want you to notice the way in which his challenge is simultaneously a conceptual challenge about how to understand, how properly to understand the situation we're in, what we are like and what nature is like and so forth, But this is simultaneously and necessarily so, particularly if he persists, a challenge to existing intellectual authorities who say otherwise. And in Luther, it's perfectly plain that in challenging the veracity of existing Roman Church teaching, he is not just challenging a bunch of ideas, he's challenging a bunch of existing legitimate structures and offices and the people in positions of authority in such offices whose job is to articulate all that true stuff. So it's a challenge to authority as well as to the veracity of particular content. Now I'm going to catch my breath and think about what is the most succinct way to get at it. Well, I guess there are two places where it's perfectly plain, or it is most plain, and then the third place where we see it in action. The two places where things are plain, it seems to me, is where Luther talks about human nature and talks about the inner man and the outer man. The other place is where he talks about the nature of the commandments in Scripture and what role they play. The third place in which you see all this in practice is the open letter to the power elite of the German-speaking culture area. That thing whose title is an address to the ruling class of the German nation. Let's start with the commandments. And while we're doing this, you just keep in mind, what does Thomas Aquinas say about these same things? Bottom of page one. The entire Scripture of God is divided into two parts, commandments and promises. Commandments and promises. The commandments, of which, among which are the famous 10 in Exodus 20, the commandments show us what we ought to do, but do not give us the power to do. They are intended to teach man to know himself, that through them he may recognize his inability to do good and despair of his own ability. For example, the commandment, you shall not covet, is a command which proves us all to be sinners, for no one can avoid coveting, no matter how much he may struggle against it. Now, let me translate this for you, just in case you don't see what's going on. Some people, especially the Roman Church, wants you to believe that the commandments, especially those 10, are in some way regulative ideals. They are things you ought to try to practice. The church itself, the mother church, is institutionalized to help you practice that and to help you deal with your inability to practice them as well as you'd like to. That is, they are essentially guides to conduct. And the more you act as if you're obeying them, in some sense, the better a person you are. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Luther thinks nothing could be more hideous and foul and false than that. In fact, as you know, this is somewhere else, he imagines that the only person capable of promulgating such a hideously false doctrine is the Antichrist himself. Satan must be sitting on the papal throne for this kind of nonsense to be going on. That's just wrong. The commandments are little lessons in human depravity. The commandments are there to show you how much you need Christ. They're there to show you that you are incapable of obeying them, no matter how much you try. They're there to show you how foul, damnable, sinful, and awful you are. That's what they're about. So that through them you may come to see how much you need Christ.